just exercising raw power isn't enough. You have to exercise that raw power to an end. And my fear is that the U.S. sanctions policies go in the same direction. We can exercise lots and lots of power, but that in the end, we're not in a position to translate that to anything.
Hello, and welcome to My Nuclear Life. I'm Shelley Lesher. Today on the show, I received a crash course on sanctions and how they are used to combat nuclear ambitions from world expert Richard Nephew. It is hard to know where to start discussing the history of the Iran nuclear program and the relationship with the U.S. I mean, in the 1960s, the U.S. supplied Tehran with a small research reactor, and Iran was well on its way to peaceful nuclear energy, which included establishing an oversight agency. The 1979 revolution soured Iran's relationship with the West, and everything becomes very complicated very quickly. This podcast can't possibly explore all the grievances, policies, and proxy wars that have occurred in the decades since. We are going to concentrate on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. If you have never heard that term, you're not alone. The press and even politicians refer to it as the Iran nuclear deal or just the Iran deal. This story starts in 2002 when U.S. President George W. Bush accused Iran of pursuing a secret nuclear weapons program after learning of the existence of a heavy water plant and a uranium enrichment facility. Shortly after, inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, met with Iranian officials to carry out facility inspections and ascertain the history of the uranium program. After signing an additional agreement with the IAEA allowing for extended inspections, Iran agreed to suspend uranium enrichment and enters into negotiations with the EU3, which are France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. The next years are filled with meetings, negotiations, inspections, restart of uranium enrichment, and lots of talk of centrifuges. Why was there so much talk of centrifuges? Uranium is an ore, and that ore is mined from the ground. When you pull a chunk of it out of the ground, it is 99.3% uranium-238. Not really a big deal. Also not a big deal is the trace amounts of uranium-234. But 0.7% of it is uranium-235. This is what is used for nuclear fuel in a reactor, but it can also be used for nuclear bombs. That just depends on the enrichment. Enrichment is just a concentration of the material. So for a nuclear reactor, you only need to enrich from 0.7% to about 3 to 5% of the uranium-235. But if you want to make a nuclear weapon, you want highly enriched uranium, which is anywhere from 20 to 85% uranium-235. Each time you run the material through a centrifuge, the more concentrated it becomes. So the more centrifuges you have and the more advanced they are, the easier it is and the faster it will be to get that weapons-grade material. Eventually, in June 2006, the EU3 get together with US, China, and Russia and now call themselves the EU3 plus 3 in Europe and the P5 plus 1 in the US and offer Iran advanced civilian nuclear technology in exchange for suspending enrichment activities. There are more meetings, more inspections, more demands, and of course, the P5 plus 1 imposes sanctions. Finally, in 2015, the P5 plus 1 and Iran sign the JCPOA. Our next stop is in 2018. Although Iran was complying with their end of the JCPOA, on March 8, 2018, President Trump removed the U.S. from the agreement and reimposed nuclear-related sanctions. As I mentioned, this is a topic way outside of my scientific wheelhouse. So lucky for us, Richard Nephew is here to give us some insight on the nuclear deal and answer questions on what we might expect from President-elect Biden's administration. Richard was the lead sanctions expert on the U.S. negotiating team for the JCPOA and is currently a senior research scholar at Columbia University. I do want to issue a warning. I spoke to Richard in November after the presidential election. Between that time and recording this introduction, tensions between Iran and the West are high again. This happened after a senior Iranian nuclear scientist was assassinated. But this is not the first time Iranian scientists have been killed. Over a two-year period in the early 2010s, four Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated and one was injured. Iran accused Israel of these attacks. Depending on when this podcast is released and when you listen to it, everything could have completely changed. Hopefully, you will still enjoy this conversation. Richard, let's start with some background for our listeners. What is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or what the public knows as the Iran nuclear deal?
The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, as the wonks call it, you know, the nuclear deal, as you said, when you get right down to it, it's a fairly simple transaction. The Iranians were required to take steps to restrict their nuclear program and open it up to greater international transparency. In exchange, they got sanctions relief. That's the basic proposition here. And, you know, it's 155 pages, but that's 155 pages of specifying essentially that, right? That there are some key things that we needed on the nuclear side that would give us confidence that the Iranians aren't producing nuclear weapons and don't have the ability to do so quickly. If they did, that we'd find out about it. And then for their side, that they get to have access to the international economy again, maybe in circumscribed, restricted ways, but still have some degree of access.
You mentioned Iran received sanctions relief. When did we place sanctions on them?
Well, the U.S. is a little unique. I mean, because we had sanctions on Iran starting in 1996. And, you know, that really starts with the U.S. comprehensive embargo and the fact that from that point forward, normal business activity between the United States and Iran has just been illegal under U.S. law. Some of those sanctions were relevant to the deal, but most of them weren't. Even under the deal, we were going to keep in place our embargo. We were still not going to have access to Iran's economy and vice versa. The sanctions that we were prepared to relieve pursuant to the JCPOA dealt with foreigners doing business with Iran. And these are the kinds of sanctions that are often called secondary. Primary, the ones that affect us, secondary affect others, that denied Iran the ability to normally do business in Germany or China or Japan and so forth. And we did that by basically saying, if you do business in Iran, you can't do business here, and presenting that as a threat to countries around the world and to their economy. So they had to make that choice. And when they made that choice, they decided not to. And so that active period of sanctions really began in earnest in 2006. There are a few things before that, but 2006 was really the start. And they were in place and doing a lot of good, acting in complement to the UN Security Council resolutions for about 7 years before we got the initial breakthroughs that led eventually to the JCPOA.
What are some examples of these primary sanctions?
The primary ones cover everything, right? So it's part of the reason why you or I can't go and buy an Iranian rug and have it shipped here, right? It's the reason why you or I, if we were traveling to Iran, would find it very difficult to use our credit cards, right? So those primary sanctions cover most everything. The ones that are relevant to the JCPOA covered investment in Iran's oil and gas sector. Those were sanctions that started in 1996, even though those have secondary characteristics. And then things dealing with civil aviation, things dealing with pistachios and carpets, those are things that were going to be relieved pursuant to the JCPOA.
How do these sanctions impact the Iranian on the ground, the everyday citizen?
The primary sanctions, I mean, they affected things because they couldn't get access to U.S. products. And so, you know, there were a couple of things that only the U.S. makes that are problematic if you're an everyday Iranian that you couldn't get access to. So you couldn't have access, at least legal access, to U.S., you know, textiles, you know, so no Nike shirts, right? You couldn't have access if you're just getting U.S. electronics. So, you know, for a long time, iPhones, for instance, were things that you couldn't get if you were an Iranian. Although we actually relaxed those sanctions in the mid part of the Obama administration. So, I mean, there were a couple of specific things. But primarily, the Iranians just got on and doing business with Europe, doing business with Japan and Korea and other places. Things really got tight for the Iranians when the primary sanctions gave way to secondary ones. And when we were restricting their access to Germany, to Japan and other places, that's where things got much more complicated if you're an Iranian, because they didn't have access to all those sorts of goods, but now from the broader international community. And then, of course, related to all this is the fact that Iran itself got poor as a result of U.S. sanctions. So, you know, GDP declined, unemployment went up, inflation went up. And that's where there was actual concrete damage that was being done to Iranians right in kind of central humanitarian areas, like, you know, food and medicine and things like that. Those are effects that still linger today under the Trump administration's actions.
I thought medicine and food were exempt from sanctions.
That's right. No, there aren't explicitly. And you could buy U.S.-made aspirin if you're in Iran. It costs several thousand times what it cost before because of inflation, because of the exchange rate depreciation, the fact that Iranian currency is basically worthless. And look, this is the problem with sanctions, right? You can say we've got all these humanitarian exemptions, and it's true. It is 100% true that humanitarian goods are not subject to U.S. sanctions. But if you can't afford it, it doesn't really matter all that. Right? It's completely illegal in the United States, at least most places, to buy medicine and things like that as well. It doesn't mean that you could do it if you don't have any money. And that's the problem that's really affected Iran in the last several years. It's the fact that they just simply don't have the financial wherewithal to be able to afford these things that otherwise they would be able to import.
You just mentioned increased unemployment and inflation in Iran. Could you expand on what that means to an Iranian compared to someone from the U.S.?
Suzanne Maloney wrote a magnificent book about economics under the revolution, right? And basically details what happened in the economy from the revolution forward. And in there, she makes a really compelling argument that Iranians at this point have gotten used to 30% unemployment. It's just a fact of nature. If you had 30% unemployment in the United States, you've got a recipe for massive political upheaval. In fact, we just saw this, right? You know, with COVID, we saw when unemployment was in double digits and we saw massive political pressure. We saw massive disruption to the economy. In Iran, they don't like it. I mean, nobody would like 30% unemployment, but it does mean something a little bit different when you say it there, because it's a little bit less like catastrophe and a little bit more like Tuesday. And the same thing applies to inflation. The same thing applies to a lot of these economic indicators. And it's why, as a sanctions guy, I have to look beyond just the raw numbers, right? You know, if you hear unemployment's 30%, you think, oh my God, well, how could they survive? Well, yeah, it's not good. But on the other hand, if that's your everyday, it's not as significant a change when you have it go from 30 to 36 than if, for instance, in our case, you go from 4 to 16.
Yes, that's a bigger change. This leads to what I want to discuss next. What were the reasons for the Trump administration to leave the JCPOA?
I think that the reasons, when you get right down to it, were the JCPOA didn't do enough. That's our argument. It wasn't that the JCPOA wasn't working. The Trump administration certified, in fact, that Iran was complying with the terms of the JCPOA. It wasn't that it didn't set back Iran's nuclear program from the precipice. There have been some quibbling about the numbers. Some people say it's 9 months, not a year, under the JCPOA from Iran's ability to produce its first nuclear weapon. Good people of good faith can argue about some of that stuff. But the real issue was that it didn't get restrictions that went long enough. It didn't get restrictions that went deep enough. And it didn't deal with other issues like, for instance, Iran's support for terror groups and whatnot in the Middle East. And the argument from the Obama administration and from others, you know, subsequent to the Obama administration is, yeah, but that wasn't its purpose, right? You know, my car is not a very good submarine. On the other hand, it's not supposed to be a submarine, right? So giving it a negative marks on the basis of something it's not equipped to do is not exactly right. But that, again, is the Trump administration's argument, at least on one side, is that, well, that's why we need to negotiate a better deal. And so their argument has been that by going back to the sanctions campaign, we'll persuade Iran to make those deeper cuts to the nuclear program and go farther in regional activities and so forth than they did under Obama.
I once heard you refer to the Trump administration plan as a maximum sanction pressure campaign, but not a maximum pressure campaign. Could you explain what you mean by that?
It's the difference between what sanctions are and what sanctions create. Right. What this administration has done is they put as much a sanctions regime as possible in place against the Iranians. And there are sanctions on everything. You know, they just announced new ones today. And they've said, for instance, for the duration of the Trump administration, that they're going to have new sanctions every single week. OK, fair enough. But what that has to generate is actual pressure on the regime. It has to generate political change if it's going to be an effective campaign. And that's the difference that we're seeing here, is that the Iranians are under sanctions, but they haven't yet found themselves under sufficient political pressure that they have to make concessions. And until they get to that point, all we're doing is just piling on abuse on the Iranians. Now, it may be that you have to do one to get to the other, but this is the tough part of sanctions. Knowing when you have gone beyond just imposing costs that are going to lead to political change and when you're just spinning your wheels. And I think that the fear and concern I've got is that we've put a lot of sanctions in place, but it hasn't actually generated the political pressure because the Iranians aren't prepared to make the concessions the Trump team is looking for.
Is some of this that we don't have the backing of the world that we had the first time around, that we don't have these secondary sanctions?
Right. Yeah. Well, it's a huge part of the reason why sanctions hasn't translated to pressure. So because of the nature of the U.S. economy and being the big gorilla that we are, we're in a position to really affect financial activity around the world. Right. If we say it's either us or them, and you're going to choose between banking with Iran and banking with New York, I think you know which direction you're going to take things. And that's the reason why we haven't needed international cooperation to mount this massive sanctions campaign we have and to impose massive economic penalties on the Iranians. But what's happened is that the Iranians know that the Europeans aren't part of this, right? They're having it done to them, not with them. And so what that's given the Iranians is a sense that we may be under lots of economic pressure, but the U.S. is isolated internationally. And that's given them the ability to argue both internally and then eventually externally. If we don't make any responses towards the U.S. that undermine the JCPOA, then we'll keep Europe on our side. Then we'll keep Russia on our side. Then we'll keep China on our side. And that will diffuse at least some of the pressure that's placed on us to make changes. And I think that's been the practical consequence, is that without international cooperation, we've got lots and lots of sanctions, lots and lots of pain, but we haven't yet convinced the Iranians that they have to make a change to salvage their international standing position.
This sounds a little bit like Cuba. We placed sanctions on Cuba, but we were the only ones that did, and there wasn't much change there. Are there some parallels?
Oh, there are huge parallels there. I mean, the difference that I would say with Cuba is there, at least during the 60s and throughout the Soviet Union's existence, they were getting direct support from the Soviets, whereas the Iranians aren't that. They're not getting direct support from the Russians or Chinese. I mean, they're getting some business and trade relationships with that. They're not actually getting, you know, we're going to buy up your sugar and things like that. Like they were getting, the Cubans were getting rather from the Soviets. But the parallel of lots and lots of pressure is still not actually generating political change, notwithstanding how long it's in place, is absolutely there. Another analogy I like to give, and it's slightly controversial, but I still think it makes a little bit of sense, is the Vietnam analogy, right? We dropped more munitions on Vietnam than we had dropped in the Second World War, right? We prosecuted a war against the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong for much longer than we did against the Japanese and the Germans. We put the power of a superpower against the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. And yet, in the end, that didn't mean all that much, at least in terms of the eventual settlement, and we were defeated in Vietnam. And the reason why is just exercising raw power isn't enough. You have to exercise that raw power to an end. And my fear is that U.S. sanctions policies go in the same direction. We can exercise lots and lots of power, but that in the end, we're not in a position to translate that to anything. So it's like an engine where you don't have a linkage between the engine itself going to the wheels. It'll keep going as hard as you press the pedal, but it won't make the car move.
What do you see is going to happen between now and the transition to the new administration? Is there much harm that can be done?
I think there's going to be an attempt to ratchet up the pressure on the Iranians. Elliot Abrams, you know, who's the special representative at this point, you know, said even today, maybe yesterday, when he was meeting with the Israeli prime minister, that we're going to keep, you know, putting the pressure on to support negotiations because that's what we wanted to do too. So, you know, they've also said, you know, more quietly in the Israeli press that they're expecting to do sanctions announcements every week. So, you know, what does that add up to? That adds up to a week's worth of sanctions announcements, but not necessarily to meaningful change on the Iranians. It's also possible that they could look to ratchet up the pressure in other ways. There's always the oft-talked about military action. I think that's fairly unlikely. Covert action, that seems more plausible, but of course, it's always hard to see what that looks like anyway. There's also things they could potentially do in the quasi-military, quasi-economic realm. Some people have talked about looking to set up a blockade of Iran to stop its ships from being able to sell oil and so forth. I don't think that's likely. It certainly doesn't seem to be the kind of thing you're going to do when you have an acting Secretary of Defense and an acting Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, But on the other hand, if you've got a sense that your time's about to run out and you're Secretary Pompeo, maybe that's the kind of thing that you do choose to do. So I think the bottom line is we don't know yet what they're going to do. I think the baseline assumption ought to be more sanctions. It doesn't really change the picture all that much. And Joe Biden, you know, is inaugurated on the 20th with situations more or less as it is now. But, you know, I think we are in a situation where the unpredictable is something we shouldn't discount.
Looking forward, do you have hopes that the Biden administration will move in a different direction with Iran and North Korea, for that matter?
The president-elect put out an op-ed in September via CNN where he laid out pretty clearly what his vision is, that we're going to return to the JCPOA if Iran returns to it and acts in full compliance, and then try and negotiate further on other areas of mutual concern. That's been his position for over a year and a half now. So I don't think that's going to change all that much between now and when he becomes president. I don't think it'll change at all. I think that that'll be his kind of game plan. Now, of course, the Iranians have a say in this too, right? You know, just because that's our position, if the Iranians say, well, actually, we don't want to rejoin the JCPOA in full compliance, or we don't want you to rejoin the JCPOA because of all the things you've done, or we demand compensation and so on and so forth. There's lots of things that they could do. But I think his intention is pretty well established. I think on North Korea, there's been a little bit less put out there as to potential policy changes. You know, there's been a lot of talk about realigning with allies and ensuring that we're in a much stronger position to work with the South Koreans and work with the Japanese and so forth. I think there is a desire to use the diplomatic openings that may or may not exist to try and address the problems that are there, but to do so in a meaningful way, right? And this is what's different, I think, between what a Biden presidency and what a Trump presidency would do. Trump may have been satisfied for it with a photo op and a one-page outline of mutual commitments that no one ever really respected. I think Joe Biden will expect something a little bit more serious.
Do you think the U.S. is in a weaker position going back to the JCPOA at this point?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I know we're in a much worse position across the board. You know, it's not just the JCPOA, although that's a big deal. The Iranians are still looking at how we negotiate with others. They talk, for instance, about how we renegotiated NAFTA. And, you know, they look at this and say, you didn't get much. And even in the last hours before, you know, when all the substance was agreed, your president was twisting the arms of the Mexicans to get them to make further concessions on immigration and refugee flows and things like that. So I think it's even less a will we stick to agreements once reached? It's will we stick to those? Will we faithfully negotiate those agreements? Are we intent on negotiating, but in bad faith with an intent on bringing up new issues at the end? I think there's a whole host of issues that come up. And those are just the ones that deal with the Iranians. Now we're talking about the rest of the international community, mm-hmm. right? You know, we had to negotiate with everyone to get the JCPOA, and then we walk away. And then we threaten sanctions against everyone. We had to negotiate with the UN Security Council to get snapback authorities, you know, to be able to impose snapback on the Iranians if they ever cheated unilaterally. We got people to make concessions on the UN veto in order to get the JCPOA. Do we think we're going to get that back now that we've shown we're going to use it in a ill-founded way? Probably not. So, no, we've done ourselves tremendous disservice with this attempt. And, you know, again, if it had been successful, you can make an argument that it was worth breaking those eggs in order to get a better deal. But the fact that it wasn't even successful, I think only adds insult to injury.
The way you describe it, I don't think people realize what a monumental deal this was.
No, I think so. I mean, look, I mean, the JCPOA was not just something that we came up with. And Europeans will be careful to note, they started negotiating this in 2003 with the initial talks that they had with the Iranians. And when you add to that everything that involves with the UN, and everything involved with working with the Russians and Chinese and the economics and all that, I mean, the implications of walking away, and especially walking away and still not actually achieving something, it's a pretty significant misstep.
One thing I wanted to ask is there's a lot of kind of bad will on both the U.S. and the Iranian sides before coming to the table. What did each country have to overcome to kind of step up and take a chance on each other?
Yeah, it was a lot. I mean, look, for the Iranians, you know, they still talk about the coup against Mossadegh in 1953, and they talk about the U.S. role in that. They certainly talk about support for the Shah, then they talk about the Iran-Iraq War and alleged support that the U.S. gave Saddam Hussein and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of history there. And then, of course, there's the immediate history of imposing sweeping sanctions, penalties, and things like that. For the U.S., we have everything from the hostage crisis to bombing of Beirut barracks to Khobar Towers to the IEDs that the IRGC left for us in Afghanistan and Iraq that maimed and killed American service personnel for years. So, no, there's a lot of bad blood there. And I think, you know, in the end, though, we were prepared to look not necessarily past that, but because of that, to trying to get to some sort of better understanding, at least on this core issue, because there was a recognition that none of that was good, that it'd be better if it hadn't happened, but that we didn't need it to lead to worse escalation. And that's where the nuclear issue comes in. You know, the steep fear that everyone had that Iran was going to possess nuclear weapons and that that would make all of those other problems so much worse, I think in the end led us to think it was worth taking this run. I think for the Iranians, it was looking at their economy and the damage that was being done to the integrity of the revolution and to the integrity of the Iranian government. So for everyone's sake, there was a strong national interest to make a change. And I still think that's there, but it's harder to see in the current environment.
Is there another instance when U.S. sanctions were successful in ending a country's nuclear ambition?
So you could argue that we did so with regard to Libya, right, where the combination of sanctions dealing with nuclear and terrorism-related reasons did put a lot of pressure on Gaddafi and made him make concessions. That one sort of counts. It doesn't fully count just because WMD was not the primary focus terrorism really was. But in the end, sanctions are something that can affect multiple interests. So that kind of had a role there. People often talk about South Africa, that we got the apartheid regime to give up nuclear weapons as a result of global sanctions pressure, not just U.S. To me, that doesn't quite count either because we actually got them to get rid of apartheid. And in getting rid of apartheid, we got rid of the nuclear program. And I think had it not been for apartheid, we probably wouldn't have even imposed the sanctions or certainly wouldn't have done so with as much vigor as the international community did. So that doesn't quite count for me. I think the closest comparison actually is Iraq, irony of ironies, that the sanctions that we had in place against Iraq from the end of the first Gulf War to the beginning of the second did restrain their ability to develop a nuclear weapon in a significant way. Of course, it came with the cost of also being hugely destructive to Iraqi society and to the Iraqi economy. So that's where the debate has always been, yeah, it may have worked. Not that we knew about it in 2003, but yeah, it may have worked. But in the end, was that worth it? So, you know, there are some places. I think the more interesting comparisons, but it doesn't quite get to nuclear weapons, are places where we've convinced partners and allies to walk back. You know, and this is where the Taiwan cases, the South Korea cases, even the Sweden cases come more to the fore. But of course, those weren't actual nuclear weapons programs. Those were nascent nuclear weapons programs, perhaps.
I guess I don't know those stories.
What, yeah, there's some interesting ones.
I know they worked on a bomb and gave it up, but they're probably the most unlikely country to have a bomb. So what's the story?
Well, I mean, putting it simply, it was, you know, they looked around after the Soviets tested their own and they said, you know, are we going to be dependent on a nuclear umbrella that isn't even clearly over us, you know, coming from the U.S.? And so that's where there was a lot of interest in the Swedish defense establishment about should we have our independent nuclear arsenal, which, by the way, was a theory that a lot of countries in Europe had. You go back and you read European nonproliferation history, you know, you can see thoughts on nuclear weapons in Switzerland, thoughts on nuclear weapons in West Germany. I mean, there's a lot of thoughts floating around Italy. But in the end, you know, after playing around with it, after doing some work towards it, after developing some facilities for it, you know, the Swedes were convinced that their interests were better suited by not pursuing. So they did. But part of the reason why they didn't was because they saw that there were risks in pursuing such a program and that there were benefits by not. And in particular, they thought they would have at least some loose approximation of the new U.S. nuclear umbrella and security assurances. So anyway, that in short, that convinced them, I think, to take a step back. But there's some real interesting history, actually, on Sweden.
You've been close to these issues for years, thinking, writing, teaching about sanctions, and you know how to use them effectively. Is there an issue that you find students or the public misunderstands or doesn't really consider?
So there are lots, but if I had to say the one that probably upsets me the most is when people think about sanctions as the policy rather than a tool to support policy. And that happens both for folks inside government and outside. You know, you have people say, well, we have sanctions. And, right? We have drones too. We've got the US Air Force as well. Just because we have these things doesn't mean that we are able to achieve our results with them. And that's because not every problem has a sanctioned solution. And sanctions are not always going to be helpful in solving the problems that we do have. So in the end, that's my biggest frustration, is that because they're quasi-diplomatic, because they are seen as being relatively easy to do, because they're a place where we have a disproportionate advantage, they're seen as something we can just do without having to think about downsides, without having to think about the need for more imaginative policy solutions. And so instead, what you get is, well, we have sanctions. And, you know, on Cuba, for instance, you know, we can't ever get rid of the embargo, because getting rid of the embargo will give a gift to the Castros and will mean that we are giving up on freeing Cuba. And again, you got to sit back and say, it's been 60 years, guys. I mean, how much longer are we going to put this in place? And I think the argument from some people is forever, right? Until we've removed the communist government. For others, I think the argument is, yeah, I think we need to maybe reconsider this. But it's ultimately this idea that sanctions are an independent policy unto themselves, as opposed to a tool that's intended to achieve something. And then if it doesn't achieve that something, you ought to reconsider it. That's the thing I find most frustrating when it comes to talking with folks about sanctions.
Thank you for listening. If you want to learn more about the sanctions or the JCPOA, check the show notes for resources, where I have also included a link to Richard's book, The Art of Sanctions. We would love to hear from you at mynuclearlife@protonmail.com or visit our website at mynuclearlife.com. We would appreciate it if you give us a 5-star review on iTunes and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. A very special thanks to Richard Nephew for speaking to me, John Emery for making this episode happen, and Lexi Weghorn for all of her help with this podcast. Thanks for listening, and please tune in next time when I will speak to another expert about the way nuclear science impacts your life and the world around you. I'm Shelley Lesher, and this has been My Nuclear Life.